Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a broad national and international perspective on the growing disparity of wealth and income gaps between the rich and the poor, and speak with the Vice President for Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, Darrell West, the author of a new book, Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. He joins us to discuss the 1,645 men and women who control a massive share of global assets worth $6.5 trillion and what that means for the other 99.99998% of us and what we can do to reverse the capture of our politics by the super rich as American democracy becomes more and more of a political game show orchestrated by oligarchs who in turn work with an oligarch-controlled press to perpetuate the myth of an American dream and a meritocracy. Then we'll hear from Robert Reich, who I spoke with back on February the 10th, when the new documentary feature starring him, Inequality for All, was released. He was the former Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration and has since become a leading voice for the voiceless as he tries to lead a popular revolt against the domination of our economy and politics by a handful of plutocrats and giant corporations who have purchased the best government that money can buy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He's the author of Digital Schools: How Technology Can Transform Education. And his latest book just out is Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Ian, nice to be with you.
And your book points out that globally there are 1,645 men and women who control a massive share of the world's assets worth $6.5 trillion. So this is not an American phenomenon, but is it really the sort of zenith of Adam Smith's prediction that capital will transcend nationality?
That certainly is what we are seeing, not just in the United States, but around the world. If you just look at the United States, wealth concentration is greater than at any point since the 1920s. So certainly that kind of puts it in historic context. And then when you look around the world, we see a lot of places where billionaires are working in close quarters with government officials. Sometimes billionaires are running for office. They've run for elective office in more than a dozen countries, and most of the time that they run, they actually win.
Well, of course, Berlusconi is a great example of that, the Italian billionaire who was prime minister and I'm not sure exactly whether he dodged a bullet, whether he's going to go to jail or not, but curiously enough, Berlusconi's best friend is Vladimir Putin, who is also a billionaire, albeit a secret one.
Yeah, Berlusconi certainly is the most prominent example of a billionaire winning high office, but we're also seeing the same thing in Ukraine. The new president there, Poroshenko, is a billionaire who made his money making chocolate, but we've seen billionaires emerge as leaders in Thailand, in Georgia, and in a number of other countries around the world. In fact, a lot of countries are dealing with this issue of great wealth and how it affects their political processes.
But is that true of the United States? It seems to me that what's happened in the United States is that billionaires are starting to rather brazenly interfere and, if not control, our politics. Where you have, on the Republican side, you have major politicians literally going to Las Vegas to beg at the feet of Sheldon Adelson, who was something of a kingmaker in the last election. And I'm not sure whether the same is true on the Democratic side, but I imagine the few liberal billionaires that are out there are being besieged by Democratic politicians.
We certainly are seeing a new wave of political activism on the part of billionaires and other wealthy people. I mean, it used to be if you wanted to influence the process, you would make campaign contributions. You might run some campaign ads designed to influence the electorate. But what we're seeing now goes way beyond that. We're seeing a lot of issue advocacy. We're seeing billionaires moving to the states and trying to influence referenda processes. A number of billionaires work very actively with a network of nonprofit organizations, and many of those organizations don't disclose either their donors or their spending, so we don't have detailed information on that. Others are becoming politically active through their foundations and basically using their charity to try and drive some of their ideas.
So is the connection with Citizens United, which opened the floodgate for money into politics and then subsequently created, or what is an offshoot of it, are these 501c4 supposedly social welfare vehicles that the IRS have designated for social welfare but are being used for political campaign funding with very, very few limitations. But obviously the great advantages to the wealthy are that they can secretly give money. And my understanding is that corporate leaders, for example, have always been a little leery about making overt political donations because half their customers are Democrats and half their customers are Republicans. The Koch brothers don't seem to be in any way shy away from that. But it used to be that we had something called the Fairness Doctrine in the media, which if a billionaire like Rupert Murdoch owned the media back then, as he does now, he would have had to give equal and opposite time to the opposite political point of view. But that was gotten rid of in the Reagan administration. So it seems to me that those are the two big yardsticks in terms of overt money buying political activism, the Fairness Doctrine and the Supreme Court Citizens United decision.
I mean, certainly there have been several Supreme Court decisions that have blown gaping holes in our system of campaign finance. So it's not just a question of all the big money that's coming into the political process today, but it's really the secrecy with which that is happening. That means voters are not in a position to judge the messenger that is behind particular messages. And so what we're doing is basically returning our politics to the pre-Watergate era of great secrecy and big money. And that's always a toxic combination. And then the other problem that we see today is just the general weakness of the news media. That based on the financial crisis of 2009 and thereafter, you know, that was incredibly harmful, especially at the state level. The number of state journalists covering state government is down dramatically. But then also, you know, billionaires are buying major media outlets. So Murdoch has the Wall Street Journal and Fox News. Bloomberg purchased Business Week. Jeff Bezos just purchased the Washington Post. And this is what we see abroad in some of these countries. You know, billionaires basically trying to own the vehicles for communicating with the general public.
So, but the idea of money in politics seems to me to be an inherently an advantage for billionaires, because it's if you base your politics on money, therefore he who has the most money buys the most politics. And that seems to be where we're at. I mean, our politicians have become telemarketers.
I mean, certainly there are a number of billionaires that are attempting to influence elections. I should point out that a lot of times they are failing in those efforts. You know, the most notable example was the 2012 presidential election, when conservative billionaires spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to beat Obama and lost. And we also have examples of, you know, Bloomberg pushing immigration reform but failing, Bloomberg being active on fighting gun violence, but he can't get Congress to adopt legislation in that area. The Koch brothers have been advertising against Obamacare, and they want it repealed. They have failed in that effort. But what billionaires do is they learn from their failures, and so they're now pretesting their messages, kind of altering how they're communicating. They're trying to figure out ways to be more successful in 2014 and then looking ahead to 2016.
Again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He's the author of Digital Schools, How Technology Can Transform Education. And his latest book just out is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. But when I say that our politicians have become telemarketers, Darrell West, I mean, that's actually supported by the facts. I mean, Teddy Kennedy, one of the longest-serving members of the Senate, just before he retired and became ill, in an interview with NPR, said the thing that he most noticed that changed the Senate over the years has been the influence of campaign financing and the need to raise more and more money. And he made the point that he said, you know, we used to go home for the weekends to the district, but we worked 9 to 5 and we actually did the people's business. But nowadays, you know, you leave around Wednesday or Thursday to go to fundraisers in the district and around the country, and then you come back the following Tuesday. So at the best, you work maybe Wednesday and Thursday or Tuesday and Wednesday. And that is the new norm, and that they spend all of their time, at least 80% of their time, U.S. senators dialing for dollars.
I mean, that certainly is a huge problem. And, you know, we certainly see all of the gridlock in Congress and the inability of the House and Senate to address issues. I was talking with one wealthy individual, and he described to me what he called a get-a-senator strategy, because we know in the Senate it only takes one member to place a secret hold to block a nomination, or one senator to threaten a filibuster, and that will stop the entire body from considering the bill. You know, there have been examples. The New York Times reported Wall Street financier Bill Ackman was on this campaign against the company Herbalife, and he got Senator Ed Markey to write a letter demanding an investigation of Herbalife to the Federal Trade Commission and the Securities and Exchange Commission. So we do have to be careful about this link with money, particularly in the Senate, because it only takes one individual to stop action.
So explains this new phenomenon then of billionaire political activism?
Well, what's going on today is we have a combination of great wealth concentration, great secrecy, new political tactics by which billionaires can become politically active, and a very weak news media. So there's a lot less oversight. Now, if you only had one of those things, it might not be so problematic. But when you have all those things taking place at the same time, that is what creates the problem. That's what concerns me. And it's not just a problem at the national level. A number of billionaires have gone into state referenda, and there you often do have very one-sided campaigns. And there often isn't a lot of press coverage those types of races. And so it's really at the state level where billionaires have demonstrated the greatest impact.
Well, I'm reminded from this new series on PBS by Ken Burns on the Roosevelts that it wasn't that long ago that state legislators chose or appointed U.S. senators. And that, of course, was an invitation to corruption, because it meant that the plutocrats could just buy the state legislatures, which are easier to buy, and they tend to be more for sale. And that senators used to be, you know, basically, you know, owned by the railroad companies or whatever the plutocrats of the day were. Are we heading back to that, even in spite of the 17th Amendment?
We are headed back to those days, just because the very conditions that enabled that type of very overt corruption, we're starting to see some of those same elements. Because, if you look at wealth concentration, it's as one-sided today as it was in the 1920s when a lot of these types of things were taking place. The media were weak early in the 20th century. They're pretty weak now and not able to exercise much oversight. And there's great secrecy now, which also was the case in the early part of the 20th century. And so when you combine those particular conditions, it really creates the conditions for great scandals. And I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before we start to see some pretty bad scandals.
So what's going to then reverse this trend of the wealthification of our politics?
I mean, in the book, I describe the problem, but I devote the last two chapters to trying to think about remedies, like what we can do. So certainly in terms of the governance process, we should eliminate the secret holds on appointments, and we should reduce the power of the filibuster. That would reduce the ability of a single senator just to block action or to block appointments. We also need much greater transparency in the process, just so we can see what is happening and where the money is coming from and how people are trying to influence the process. But we also need to think about kind of the broader and more structural aspects of the system, a link to income inequality. I was fortunate. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I grew up on a dairy farm. I came from a modest background, but yet I had amazing opportunities, went to public schools, got a PhD at a public university, and went on to do very well. I worry that today's kids don't have these same opportunities, and so I think broadening social and economic opportunity is part of addressing this money in politics issue, because if we can have a fairer type of income distribution, it will make it easier to have a political process that works more effectively.
But my understanding from the Citizens United decision, of which the Justice Kennedy was the swing vote or the important vote, you know, the other conservatives were way ahead of it on it, but he honestly believed that the money would be regulated or self-regulated by disclosure, that if the public knew who was giving the money to political advertising, and that's after all how most people get their political information from, is from television advertising, that it would have a balancing effect. And of course, you know, they opened the floodgates for corporate money and union money, and there's no symmetry there. The corporate money is infinitely greater. But so I'm trying to figure out, was Kennedy conned by the more conservative justices, or is he naive? Because it hasn't worked out that way.
I think he was naive because we actually are not seeing transparency. So we're not even in a situation where transparency would help level the playing field by at least publicizing what people are doing, because there's so much so-called dark money, basically money coming in secret to influence the political process. Some of it is taking place through issue advocacy campaigns. Some of it is through nonprofit organizations that don't have to disclose their contributors. I mean, there are all sorts of avenues that have been opened up by recent court rulings that basically empower secret money. And so, you know, this is creating enormous problems for our system, and something people really need to wake up and pay attention to.
So in terms of naming and shaming, which seems to be all that the Democrats have in their political arsenal running in this midterm election, where we've got Harry Reid basically running against the Koch brothers because they're in part funding Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, and they want Mitch McConnell to be the next majority leader. So he's trying to use that as a political campaign issue. I'm not sure what traction it has. I guess we'll find out in November. But is there something happening with the American public? I mean, where do we stand as a culture? Are we infatuated with billionaires? Because, you know, as you've rightly pointed out, our media has been weakened, and it's trending more towards infotainment as opposed to investigative journalism. So, and if you watch those ridiculous shows on television, particularly here in Los Angeles, where we have all of this celebrity worship from Hollywood, it's really quite sickening, and it's all about money. And I was looking at television the other night, and the big lead story was that there's a new handbag out that cost $185,000, and they were all sort of gushing over this ridiculous handbag that's, you know, what, the equivalent of the annual salaries of, what, five American families or something?
Yes, absolutely. I think Americans often are infatuated with billionaires, in part because of pop culture. You know, we like to follow what they're doing, how they're leading their lives, how they're spending their money, how they're trying to influence things. I remember about 20 years ago, Ted Turner went to Brown University, where I used to teach, to give a talk, and he said something that has really stuck with me over the years. He said that making the first million is the hardest, but after that, it becomes easy because money begets money, and once you have money, it basically gets you into social and economic networks that makes it easier to make even greater sums of money. And so I think that's kind of, you know, when I see the big money flowing today, I often have memories of that speech from many years ago.
Again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he is the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He's the author of Digital Schools, How Technology Can Transform Education, and his latest book just out is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crusts. And in your new book, Darrell West, you point out about the wealthification of our politics, this new phenomenon of billionaire political activism. But what's your sense of where the American people stand in terms of populism? Have we become so infatuated with the wealthy, with celebrity culture, that we're just basically easily distracted with bread and circuses and basically think that if we're poor, it's our own fault, as opposed to we're poor because the government has changed the taxation system and billionaires used to be, under President Eisenhower, were taxed at 92%, and nowadays Mitt Romney and company were taxed at about 15%. So there are real advantages to being rich, and there are disadvantages to being middle class and poor in this country, and those are political issues, and we ought to get off our backsides and do something about it instead of worshiping wealthy people.
I mean, it has been hard to build a political movement to address these issues in the United States. I think there is anger among the American public about how things have played out in recent years, but yet the public is divided in terms of who they are angry at. People can't decide whether they should be angry at big government, big corporations, or big money in general. And so those divisions end up dividing the public, dividing the anger, and you almost end up with a divide-and-conquer type of strategy. You know, it makes it difficult to address any of the issues associated with kind of big money in the political process.
But doesn't, though, this get to the heart of democracy itself, the idea that the one thing that we all have in common is we have that one vote, and if it's more about $1 one vote as opposed to one person one vote, then that whole sort of the heart, if you will, of democracy is, it becomes a sham.
Well, this is one of the reasons why many people are cynical about the political process, that they see insider dealing, they see conflicts of interest, they see tax policy that gets tilted towards the wealthy, and they just conclude there's nothing they can do about it, and it's kind of a hopeless situation. The only people who really aren't cynical about the political process are the ultra-wealthy, because they know that government still matters. What happens in D.C. and in state capitals has big consequences for companies and for businesses. They are very engaged in the political process. There have been public opinion surveys of the top 1%. They are much more likely to participate, to vote, to give campaign contributions than the average person, because they know that it matters. And so, you know, we end up being hurt by all the cynicism on the part of the general public, because they just look at all this and think, well, there's nothing they can do about it.
But it seems if you go back in history, you know, for 100 years or so, there are sort of ebbs and flows of American social democracy and wealth equality versus wealth inequality. If you go back to McKinley, then, of course, he was assassinated and succeeded by Teddy Roosevelt, who was a reformer, and that led to the great progressive era. And then that was reversed by the Roaring Twenties, when we had free market excesses. The pendulum swung back the other way. And then you had the crash. And then under FDR and the New Deal, the pendulum swung back the other way. And then, of course, through, I think, the more recent social democratic era, arguably from 1947 to 1977. And then after that, with the advent of Ronald Reagan, the pendulum swings back in favor of billionaires, and it's been going that way ever since, Ronald Reagan.
It certainly is a case, when you look historically over the last century, that there have been ebbs and flows in income concentration, that in the 1920s and the 1930s, income concentration was very high. It was over 20%. The top 1% earned more than 20% of the income. But then in the post-World War II period, we actually had more egalitarian policies in terms of spending as well as in tax policies, that the percentage of the income earned by the top 1% reached a low point of 8% in 1976. But then since then, it's gone the other way, and now the top 1% are back to earning over 20% of all of the income in the country. And so, you know, what that tells us is when you look at those ebbs and flows is public policy matters. Tax policy matters. That, you know, people think, well, the poor, they're always going to be with us. The rich, they're always going to be with us. Well, in fact, when you look at the numbers, there are ups and downs in terms of how much wealth rich people have and how politically active and how much political influence they have. So we can actually do things that would make a difference, and people just need to understand that.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Darrell West.
There's a place out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Darrell West, who is the author of the new book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. So tell me, why did you write this book? I think it's really taps into the political zeitgeist at the moment. I think it is the biggest issue in America. I mean, our mythology as a country is all about egalitarianism. It's all about the Horatio Alger myth of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And we've always been a meritocracy, equal opportunity for all. Those things have literally become lies of late. So I think the country needs a little bit of honesty. And I think you're giving us more than a dose of honesty here.
Well, the heartening thing is there's been a huge amount of media interest in this. And I wrote the book to find out, you know, who these billionaires are, how they got rich, and what they're doing with their immense wealth. But I also wanted to know, what are they like as people? I've been fortunate between my time teaching at Brown University and then now being at the Brookings Institution to have had encounters with about 20 different billionaires. And so I try and incorporate some of these personal stories and personal experiences in the book just to give people a flavor of, you know, what's going on, what the relationship is between money and politics, and, you know, why they should be interested in this topic.
So tell us about some of the billionaires that you met with.
Well, one of the most interesting experiences I had was with Donald Trump. This was a couple of years ago. I was interviewed by Politico, a D.C.-based newspaper, about whether Trump should address the 2012 Republican convention. And I made some comment that Republicans should send him on an all-expenses trip around the world, because if he spoke at the convention, he would bring them nothing but trouble. Now, I didn't think too much about this comment, but the morning my quote appeared, I got a phone call from Trump's assistant asking for my email address. So I gave it to her, and shortly thereafter, she sent me a missive from the billionaire himself in which he had pasted in my comment about him, and then he wrote in big, black, bold letters, "Darrell, you are a fool. Best wishes, Donald J. Trump." So I discovered some of these billionaires are a little sensitive about what you say about them.
Well, there's some doubt as to whether he's a real billionaire in the sense that he may. I've heard reports that he's fronting for, you know, other money that have invested in his real estate empire. But what about the Bloombergs, the Kochs, the Adelsons, Tom Steyer, George Soros? Any contact with any of them?
I've had contact with several of them. I mean, in 2014, this election year is actually emerging as the battle of the billionaires, because the Koch brothers are It's been reported that they will spend over $125 million trying to influence mainly the key Senate races. Tom Steyer is spending $50 million to try and influence those very same Senate races. He's interested in climate change and wants to elevate public understanding of that issue. Michael Bloomberg has pledged $50 million to fight the NRA and gun violence in America. So we're seeing a lot of political activism across the political spectrum. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things will be, how does all of this affect those Senate races? Because certainly if Republicans get the Senate back, part of that story is going to be the big money that came in early, set the agenda, kind of helped to frame Obamacare in very negative terms, and help Republicans win it back. But then if they lose, it's a question of, well, what did all this big money get them? You know, if they're not able to win a handful of crucial Senate states, you know, maybe there is some hope that big money is not going to corrupt the process.
And again, I'm speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. His latest book just out is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. So, Darrell, a friend of mine, Lauren Windsor, recently infiltrated a big Koch brothers arranged meeting down in Newport Beach at a hotel where they had several hundred of the richest Americans show up and pool their money and pledge to win the Senate for the Republicans and make sure that Hillary Clinton didn't become the next president. And somehow she managed to get all of the agenda and recordings of all of the speakers, both these Republicans like Mitch McConnell and Marco Rubio, prostrating themselves before the billionaires and other tacticians from the Koch brothers' political operations, talking about how they're going to win the Senate and kill off Hillary Clinton, etc. So I don't see anything similar happening on the Democratic side. I mean, it seems to me that most billionaires favor the Republicans, and they're a hell of a lot more organized, and that Soros doesn't seem to be interested in politics anymore. But for Tom Steyer, I don't think there's anybody out there helping the Democrats.
Well, in 2012, if you look at the big money, meaning the money that went into the super PACs, about 80% of those contributions went in on the Republican side. So certainly in that year, it was very strongly tilted in favor of Republicans. There's a little more Democratic big money that's coming in this year in some of the crucial Senate races. The Democrats actually are outspending some of the Republicans. But I think when we look ahead to 2016, Democrats have a dilemma because they really can't figure out what to do about the billionaires. Because, you know, we have Harry Reid going on the floor of the Senate kind of lambasting the Koch brothers at every opportunity. But then Hillary Clinton's super PAC is signing up billionaires. Like George Soros has signed up as a co-finance of the chair of the Ready for Hillary super PAC. And so I think, you know, 2016 is going to be a multi-billion dollar campaign. Each side is going to need its own billionaires in order to be competitive.
But it seems to me, then, and I think this lesson was very clear in the recent Scottish referendum, that one of the reasons the Scots wanted to get out of England was because they disgusted with the Conservative Party that dominates their politics, but there's not any representation in Scotland for the Tories. They're almost entirely represented by the Labour Party that's out of power. And Labour, of course, carried the mantle for the argument. And apparently people in Scotland were equally disgusted with Labour because they feel that Labour under Tony Blair moved towards the billionaires, just as the Democrats under Bill Clinton moved towards the billionaires. So is there a trend on the political left in the advanced democracies and here in the United States that these parties that are supposed to represent working people and middle-class people have basically forgotten about who their constituents are and have alienated a lot of their constituents because they need billionaires' money?
That certainly is an issue in a number of different countries. In the United States, Democrats are divided between the Clinton wing, which basically tries to get a lot of Wall Street money and has been successful at doing that, versus the Elizabeth Warren wing, which is more populist, more hostile to Wall Street and more likely to call for public policies that are more egalitarian in their overall thrust. And so I think one of the interesting aspects of the 2016 presidential election will be how that divide plays out on the Democratic side. You know, is Hillary Clinton simply just going to be able to go forward and capture the nomination without a lot of discussion of these kinds of issues? Or is there going to be a viable alternative who emerges that can raise these issues, kind of put up a good fight, and at least generate a healthy discussion about these kinds of issues?
Well, let me suggest the name of Bernie Sanders in that regard, except I don't know how he's going to get in the debates because he's technically independent. But it would sure make it more interesting, I would think. But just in closing, Darrell West, just give our audience a sense of why they should get your book.
Well, I think they should get the book because it really goes into details about this relationship between money and politics. I have a lot of stories about personal encounters I've had with billionaires, so the book tries to be readable and accessible and entertaining for people. I try and put some facts on the table because, you know, this topic generates a lot of polarization and a lot of controversy, but I think when people look at the facts in terms of what actually is going on, it would put them in a stronger position in terms of how they could think about some of these kinds of issues.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Darrell West.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who is the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he is the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. His latest book, Just Out, is Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, who I spoke with back on February the 10th at the time of the release of the new documentary feature starring him, Inequality for All. It also, of course, starred Nick Hanauer, who you may remember from the famous TED Talk. And he, of course, is a billionaire who's warning his fellow billionaires that the pitchforks are coming and that income inequality is unsustainable and that rich people like him can only eat a few meals at restaurants and only can drive three or four cars. They can't have 200 cars in their driveways. So again, we'll be joined in a moment by Robert Reich.
If I were a rich man, all day long I biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Lost, lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. Oh, all of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Reich, the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Reich.
Hello, Ian. Good to talk to you.
And we now learn, of course, that in terms of inequality for all, it's a global issue. Just before the recent Davos conference in the Swiss Alps, Oxfam came out with a report that only 85 individuals on this planet have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the globe's population of 3.5 billion people. So your film is right on the money, right?
Well, sadly, it is. Inequality keeps growing, not only in the United States, but in every advanced rich nation. Now, global inequality has been with us for some time, obviously. But when you have every advanced nation and then some developing nations, certainly inequality is rampant in Russia and in China. The combination is, you get the combination that Oxfam showed, that you've got 85 people who have as much income, as much wealth as half of the entire world's population.
So recently there was a front page story in the New York Times indicating that in effect we are in a plutonomy. Our economy has become a plutonomy. And I remember a few years ago there was a leak from a memo from a Citigroup of an analyst inside Citigroup suggesting that maybe we could get by with our consumer economy depending entirely on the rich. This recent report in the New York Times indicates that sales of luxury goods and at high-end restaurants are up, and at low-end restaurants like McDonald's they're up, but in the middle, the Sears, the JCPenney's, and the Olive Garden restaurants are really hurting. So I recall in your film, Nick Hanauer, the patriotic billionaire, basically saying, look, I'm a rich guy, but I can't go to 300 restaurants. In fact, I don't like dining out.
Ironically, Ian, that's one of the big problems from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, because when so much of our income and wealth is going to a smaller and smaller number of people at the top who can't possibly spend it, I mean, even if they tried, 24/7, they couldn't possibly spend everything that's coming into them. The vast middle class, meanwhile, doesn't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going. Since the recovery began, the recovery from the Great Recession, and I say so-called recovery, I mean, most people don't feel like they are actually in a recovery, but since it began in September of 2009, 95% of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%. Which means that, most people are not seeing any recovery, and that means they can't turn around and buy very much. And if they can't turn around and buy very much, then the economy is kind of stuck. It's a vicious cycle. It's just the reverse of the virtuous cycle we had in the 1950s, 1960s, and early 1970s, in which a growing middle class had the ability to turn around and buy things that generated more jobs and better wages.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Reich, the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. Well, your film, Inequality for All, points out, I think, in many ways that we go through these cycles in American history. We had the original Gilded Age back at the turn of the 20th century, and that was followed by the accidental presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, a progressive era, then the Depression, and then the era that you pointed out from 1947 to 1977, we effectively had a social democracy. But then since Reagan, it's gone in the opposite direction. So what's your sense of where we are in terms of these ebbs and flows?
Well, we're coming up to what is probably a tipping point. That is, when median household incomes are dropping, adjusted for inflation, but a small group at the top is getting wealthier than they've ever been before, and they are paying a lower and lower percentage of their income in taxes, then the ranks of the poor are growing. That's a recipe for social and economic and political disaster. I mean, we can't continue to go in this direction, obviously. So the choice is either reform, which is the usual choice we've taken. As you said, in the progressive era, between 1901 and 1914, we chose reform. In the New Deal, during the Great Depression, we chose reform. In the 1960s, with regard to civil rights and voting rights, we chose reform. Now, this time, if we don't choose reform, we're going to be in a terrible, vicious cycle that gets just worse. I mean, what's the alternative to reform? The alternative to reform is revolution, and revolution is very risky. Revolutions can turn out very, very badly. The American Revolution turned out pretty well, but not all revolutions do. I would I would opt for reform, and I think that that's the likely U.S. response, the likely American response. But the question is, when? Is it going to happen in the next couple of years? Are Americans going to become so concerned and upset with this the huge gap, not only economically, but a gap between our ideals of equal opportunity and not having an aristocracy that passes on its wealth to a kind of a dynasty, dynasties of wealth, a country that's becoming more and more unequal? Are we going to become upset to the point where people begin organizing and mobilizing and taking action, political action? Or are we going to just simply to wait until things get so out of kilter that the economy cannot function, our democracy is so overrun with big money that it cannot even begin to respond, and we have no choice but sort of an uprising?
So do you sense, though, in this election year, this midterm election year, that this issue of inequality is in the zeitgeist? I know that the president has made some speeches along those lines, and my sense is that unless this year the White House pulls out all the stops and runs as though they're running in a presidential election, because it's really about turnout. If you look at 2008, 145 million voted. 2 years later, the Democrats got trounced in the midterms, where only 75 million voted. So if the Republicans have learned something from the last election, they're going to spend more money. They're probably going to have clever strategies. So unless the Democrats have turnout, I think we're going to have a very lame duck president. And if the Republicans take the Senate, then the plutocracy has a lock, not that they don't already.
Yeah, well, that easily could be the case. Democrats need to be talking about this. If there was ever a case for a Democratic Party, it is now. If there was ever a case for a Democratic agenda in terms of a shared prosperity, it is now. Increasing the minimum wage substantially, making it a living wage, raising taxes on the very wealthy, and reducing Social Security and payroll taxes on low-wage workers, getting rid of the tipped minimum wage, which is a scandal. I mean, you know, tipped workers are only earning $2.13 an hour. Reviving the Glass-Steagall Act so that Wall Street doesn't have another bout of melting down because it's taking too many risks with your money and my money, putting a cap on the size of the big banks. We could go on and on. Real investments in education and job training, not the kind of around the investments we're making are paltry compared to what we need. And the same thing goes for infrastructure. We've got so many long-term unemployed. We ought to be putting people to work, rebuilding the country, teachers' aides, and working on roads and bridges and parks. You know, a new WPA, a Civilian Conservation Corps, like we had in the 1930s. This country has shown itself in the past to have the resilience to do what is necessary. And the question now for Democrats and for the rest of us, even if you are not political, is to become politically engaged and push the politicians in this direction.
So as long as, of course, as we export our jobs and import cheap labor, structurally it seems that we're doomed. And talking again about the 85 individuals that have wealth equivalent to half of the world's population, it does seem that Adam Smith's idea of capital transcending sovereignty is happening, that we have a kind of global group of plutocrats who really don't have any adherence to national policy. Could we have a movement towards a patriotic economy? I mean, in other words, can we...
And we've got to be very careful. If we go back into isolationism and chauvinism and jingoism, the kinds of things that have caused huge problems in the past, then we're not really improving standard of living for anybody, and we're condemning many people in developing nations to lives of deep hardship and poverty. One of the worst things we do, for example, is to give our wealthy agribusinesses gigantic subsidies, and we have tariffs on agricultural imports, which hurt developing nations desperately because they are dependent on their agricultural exports, don't help average workers in this country who have to pay more for the food that they buy, but end up really just enriching a handful of not really farmers. They're called farmers, but they're really giant agribusinesses. Well, that's the kind of thing that we've got to crack down on. Get rid of all of the corporate welfare. You know, we are subsidizing not only agribusiness, but the oil companies, major national gas companies. We're subsidizing military contractors. We've been doing this for years. It's getting worse. We're subsidizing the drug companies, pharmaceutical manufacturers. We are doing all of their basic research and yet giving them extraordinary patent protections. If you talk about our government, I mean, the issue is not the size of the government. The issue is who government is for. And right now, too often, the government is for the very, very wealthy individuals who are making the big campaign contributions and also the big corporations that are also making big campaign contributions. We need stronger unions in this country. Fewer than 7% of private sector workers are unionized. There's no bargaining power in the private sector on behalf of working people.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Reich, the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. Well, it would seem that since the wealthy control our government, they're getting the kind of government that they want, and it's working well for them, and that they're also at the same time telling us that government doesn't work, and that's been going on since Ronald Reagan. Where do you think the narrative, apart from your film, Inequality for All, is coming from or can come from to make people recognize that they can take back their government and they can have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people?
Well, that's why we did the film, really, Ian, basically to connect the dots, to show people what's going on, not to create or demonize anybody, not to create villains, but to make sure people understand how the system is now working and failing to work and why it's failing to work. Getting big money out of government and out of politics is probably more important than almost anything else, because we can't do anything else until we get big money out of our politics. In the other hat I wear when I'm not teaching here at UCal Berkeley is I'm chair of a citizens group called Common Cause, which has been fighting for years, and it keeps on growing, and the fight keeps on growing as well, against big money in politics. We must do that. The Supreme Court's really insane decision in Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission, that 2010 decision, has got to be reversed. We've got to demand that it be reversed. We've got to have a constitutional amendment to reverse it, if nothing else will reverse it. And we've got to have campaign, public financing of all general election campaigns.
Well, in terms of, just to clarify, I wasn't suggesting earlier, Robert Reich, about bringing back any kind of Smoot-Hawley protectionism, but rather sort of engendering some kind of sense of patriotism in terms of our economy for people, for example. A lot of people find Apple products incredibly good, and they are, and they deserve to be successful. On the other hand, we learn that they're parking an awful lot of their profits abroad. So isn't there a question there that could be addressed?
Oh, yes, there's a huge question. I mean, big corporations, have trillions of dollars outside the United States. They're not bringing back to create jobs here. They're just parking it abroad to save money and their... some big companies are setting up a kind of hedge funds with them, all the money that they have abroad. They're not even investing it. They're not. They're doing nothing with it. This isn't building a competitive economy. This is just adding to the casino. So we do need to create both tax penalties for companies that hide their money abroad, and also tax incentives to bring the money back.
But also on a domestic front, aren't these big corporations also buying back stock and not investing in R&D and driving up the price of stock?
Exactly. I mean, Apple is a good, a sad example. I mean, you'd think of all companies that should be investing in technology and has in the past invested substantially in new technology. I mean, Apple is using a big portion of its savings to buy back its shares of stock. It's also borrowing in global lending arenas to buy back its shares of stock. Now, this when companies buy back their stock, which is what companies are doing like mad now, all they're doing is they're artificially raising the price of their stock because when they buy it back, there's less stock remaining, and that creates higher demand. But that's not doing anything for the long term. That's the most unimaginative and silly way of spending your shareholders' money that anybody can imagine. Any company that is buying back its own stock, you know, its current shareholders and institutional investors and pension funds ought to be asking, why are you doing that? Don't you have any ideas for the long term at all?
And I thank you so much for joining us, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you, Ian. I should also add that it is already on DVD and iTunes and on demand, and in a couple of weeks it will be on Netflix.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Reich, who's the author of Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and is a Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the subject of the new feature documentary, Inequality for All. And you were just listening to Robert Reich, who I spoke with back in February the 10th, when the new documentary feature starring him, Inequality for All, was released. He, of course, is the former Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration and has since become a leading voice for the voiceless, and he's been trying to lead a popular revolt against the domination of our economy and politics by a handful of plutocrats and giant corporations who have purchased the best government that money can buy. And again, there, of course, is a constitutional amendment that is making its way through legislatures, and that is certainly a direction that the public can go to turn back the control of our politics and our economy by the 1%. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.